Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Tragic aftermath. The number of confirmed dead rises to 22 as rescue workers continue to scour the rubble of the Surfside, Florida condominium collapse. Then, leaving Afghanistan, the U.S. military hands over a critical base after 20 years of war, leaving the future of the country in question. Plus, at the extreme, widespread drought raises concerns of another dangerous fire season as the western U.S. struggles to recover from last year's fires.
If we try to attack this problem like we always have, assuming that it's the same problem, we will not find success. And if the environment we're operating in changes, and it obviously has, then we have to change too.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down the Supreme Court's ruling on voting rights and the criminal charges filed against former President Trump's business. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The confirmed death toll has risen to 22 in the collapse of that condominium tower in Surfside, Florida. The number of missing dropped from 145 to 126 as some people turned up safe and officials removed duplicate names. And they also announced that they are going to demolish the remaining part of the tower once engineers have signed off. Crews kept working today after recovering more victims overnight. The mayor said one was the 7-year-old daughter of a Miami firefighter, a discovery that hit all of them hard.
Last night was uniquely different. It was truly different and more difficult for our first responders. These men and women are paying an enormous human toll each and every day, and I ask that all of you please keep all of them in your thoughts and prayers.
As the work continued, officials also kept an eye on Elsa, the first Atlantic hurricane of 2021. The storm hit Barbados today in the eastern Caribbean with winds of 85 miles an hour and heavy rain. It could reach South Florida by early next week. The rebound in the U.S. economy is showing even more strength. The Labor Department reports a net gain of 850,000 jobs in June, the most in 10 months. Average hourly wages rose 3.6% from a year earlier as businesses offered incentives to workers. The unemployment rate, however, ticked up to 5.9% as more people entered the labor force. The World Health Organization warned today that the Delta variant of COVID-19 has opened a dangerous new phase in the global pandemic. It is spreading in nearly 100 countries, and infections across Africa are doubling every 3 weeks. In India, where the Delta variant first appeared, the official death toll topped 400,000 today. The true total is believed to be far higher. The Delta variant is also spreading in the U.S. as the 4th of July weekend arrives. More than 47 million people are expected to travel for the holiday, but a third of all U.S. adults are not yet vaccinated. At the White House today, President Biden said that means too many people are still at risk.
I am not concerned there's going to be a major outbreak. In other words, that we're going to have another epidemic nationwide. But I am concerned lives will be lost.
At the same time, the president welcomed what he called a summer of freedom. He will host a White House cookout for more than 1,000 people on Sunday. We'll talk with one of the senior Biden administration officials monitoring the pandemic, Dr. Vivek Murthy, a little later in the program. The U.S. military has all but completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan today, departing Bagram Airfield after nearly 20 years. The withdrawal is running well ahead of President Biden's deadline of September 11th. He said today it's up to the Afghan government to unify in the face of rapid Taliban advances. In Iraq, a widespread power outage led to public outrage, with temperatures hitting 118 degrees. It affected millions from Baghdad south to Basra. At Friday prayers, men hid under parasols and carried signs blaming the government. Officials did not confirm reports that militants cut a major transmission line. Back in this country, an independent review commission formally recommended that outside prosecutors, and not military commanders, handle sexual assault cases in the uniformed services. President Biden endorsed the proposal. He did not address calls in Congress for outside prosecutors to handle all major crimes in the military. And on Wall Street today, the three major indexes all hit record closes, helped by the June jobs report. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 152 points to close at 34,786. The Nasdaq rose 117 points, and the S&P 500 added 32. Still to come on the News Hour, on the ground in Afghanistan as the U.S. military leaves after 20 years of war. The U.S. Surgeon General discusses the threat of new COVID variants and the vaccination effort. Widespread drought raises concerns of another dangerous fire season for the western U.S., plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
For more than a week, rescue teams have worked tirelessly to clear and search the rubble of that collapsed condominium building in Surfside, Florida. Amna Nawaz has this conversation recorded this evening before news of the emergency order to demolish the remainder of the partly collapsed building.
Judy, rescue efforts resumed late yesterday after a 14-hour pause over concerns that parts of the building that remain standing could fall and endanger workers. Weather issues, including heavy rain and lightning storms, have also slowed or halted work in recent days. And now, as we reported earlier, Hurricane Elsa is on course to reach the Florida coast this weekend. All this as rescue workers continue their mission around the clock. We turn now to Michael Fagel. He served as a safety and logistics officer after both the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 and the World Trade Center attacks on September 11, 2001. He now teaches disaster management and has written a number of textbooks on the subject. Michael Fagel, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for being with us. We should say we're on day 9 now of the search and rescue efforts on the ground there. Last night, the terrible news. They pulled the body of a 7-year-old daughter of a Miami firefighter from the rubble there. Help us understand, for the rescue workers doing the work right now, what is it like? What's going through their minds?
They are on pure adrenaline right now. These folks are working 12-hour shifts or not longer. And even when they stop to rest, they don't rest. They're still doing 100 miles an hour. These people are dedicated to try and find every person that they can, and they just don't want to stop.
No survivors have been pulled from the wreckage since the hours after the collapse last Thursday. They're still in a search and rescue mission. When does that turn to search and recovery?
When it changes to recovery will be what the on-the-ground commanders decide. Could be several days. Remember, it was 11 days with Mexico City, and it was 8 days with Haiti. So they're evaluating every condition in their unified command as we speak. And that's a decision that's going to be a hard decision to make because nobody wants to give up.
You know, at that site, there is this collapsed tower, the South Tower. There's also a North Tower just about 100 yards away that is, of course, still standing, was built by the same developers at the same time. FEMA has now said that they will temporarily relocate residents of that building if they wish to leave, but they haven't been ordered to evacuate. I wonder, from your experience, what your take is. Should those residents leave that other building?
I know that when we did other evacuations, that if you have an opportunity to leave while it's safe, I would highly recommend doing so. I'm not an engineer, but I suspect that various engineers have suggested there may be similar conditions. So if I was given the opportunity to evacuate, I would.
As we mentioned, Hurricane Elsa is now threatening the coast. Give us a sense of how that's changing the rescue work on the ground.
Of course, with wind and weather, those issues will certainly exacerbate the issues. The crews are going to keep working as safely as they can for as long as they can. But when you had wind, weather, shifting debris as we had yesterday, when a beam moves 6 to 12 inches, all those things just add to the entire problem that must be evaluated minute by minute.
I wonder, too, if you'd weigh in on this, because obviously the safety of the workers is at the foremost of everyone's minds right now. But what about the long-term safety? I think back to the rescue workers who were there after 9/11 and many of them inhaling the dust and who knows what else afterwards. Are you concerned based on what you've seen about the long-term health of those rescue workers at Surfside?
Absolutely. And it's something that will rear its ugly head at the very unknown times. I tried to keep people safe when I was at Ground Zero. I succumbed to cancer 10 years later. So you just don't know. I lost a kidney and some lung function. These folks are going to be they need to be monitored so carefully. They need to say, I need medical attention, and they need mental health support as well. Don't be afraid, because the long-term effects of critical incident will last with them for their lifetime and for their families. Don't ignore it.
Michael Fagel, you know what it is to be in those rescue working teams. And I wonder if you had a brief message for those on the ground doing the work right now, what would that be?
Don't give up, don't panic, and stay safe. And please, please obtain medical attention and mental health support. Don't be afraid, it's okay.
That is Michael Fagel joining us tonight. And of course, our thoughts remain with the people and those rescue workers down in Surfside, Florida. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
A generation of American military presence in Afghanistan is nearing its end. But what comes next? Here's Nick Schifrin.
The sprawling hub of American operations in Afghanistan for nearly two decades, Bagram Airfield, is now in the hands of the Afghan government. U.S. defense officials say all American forces outside of the Kabul airport and embassy have left the country. President Biden today suggested the country's challenges are now the Afghans' problem.
We have worked out an over-horizon capacity that we can be value-added, but the Afghans are going to have to be able to do it themselves with the Air Force they have, which you're helping them maintain. I'm not going to answer any more questions on Afghanistan. Look, it's 4th of July. I'm concerned that you guys are asking me questions that I'll answer next week, but this is a holiday weekend. I'm going to celebrate it.
So what of this moment in Afghanistan and its very uncertain future? Our Jane Ferguson joins me from Kabul. Jane, good to see you. Talk about the mood on the ground in Kabul. How does the government feel? How does the city feel?
Government officials, Nick, are trying to make sense of what the next coming weeks and months are going to mean for them. They've spent the last months trying to make sure that they could secure the U.S. funding, that $4 billion a year for the Afghan security forces. But now they have much bigger concerns whether or not they can hold any more ground against the Taliban. And to a certain extent, some of the political leadership here has really gone to ground. And the president here, Ashraf Ghani, seems increasingly isolated in the palace. Now, across Kabul, in the streets and in cafes and restaurants that we've been out to today, there isn't a sense of panic. People are getting on with their daily lives, but there's a deep sense of fear. Whether or not the Taliban could come back here, or whether or not they'll see more of a civil war taking place and a new phase in this war. And don't forget, Nick, that the vast majority of the population here in Afghanistan are too young to remember Taliban rule. Their parents and grandparents remember Taliban rule, and many people deeply fear a return to that. And in turn, you're seeing a huge amount of them trying to get out of the country. There's also the important topic of what will happen for women here. And I've spoken to those who run women's shelters across the country, and they've had to evacuate many of those shelters within territory that was about to or had fallen to the Taliban and move vulnerable women, those who are being helped because they're coming from abusive situations or they've been released from jail and they have children. Many of those women who don't have anywhere else to go have had to flee those shelters and move into government-controlled areas, which, as you well know, are becoming smaller and smaller.
And those fears outside of Kabul are also about fighting, not only between the Taliban and the Afghan military, but also local militias now fighting.
Absolutely. We've seen, since President Biden's announcement that there would be an unconditional withdrawal, a huge uptick in violence by the Taliban. And the tactics are fairly clear. They want to take rural areas between the major cities, essentially choking off those cities. And for now, they've managed to take many districts across the country. And part of the tactic as well is to draw the ANDSF, the Afghan security forces, the government security forces, into fighting on way more fronts than they can really manage to do so. To draw them into fighting across the country and stretching them thin on many different areas. So in response to that, the government is essentially handing out weapons to civilians and encouraging what it calls popular uprisings, essentially militias across the country, to try to get them to go out and support the Afghan government security forces. We've been out there ourselves with these militias as they fight the Taliban next to the Afghan army. They are civilians. Many of them have never fought before. Some of them have been in militias way back during the 1990s civil war. And they're being handed guns by the government and told to help protect their own areas and other areas here that are under threat of falling to the Taliban.
As U.S. service members are leaving, also leaving are U.S. contractors who have been servicing Afghan Air Force helicopters. The U.S. is trying to figure out a solution there. But, Jane, how important is that?
Air support for the Afghan security forces is absolutely crucial, and the loss of it could completely tip the balance of power on the battlefield across Afghanistan. We've already seen at least one unit of Afghan special forces last month being killed by the Taliban because they didn't have any backup.
And finally, Jane, the U.S. is also trying to figure out what to do in terms of future airstrikes, how to get Afghan translators out of the country, and how to secure the airport. How important is it that the U.S. finalize those deals?
There are so many questions still left, Nick. As you've said, we don't yet know exactly what the rules of engagement will be. Will the U.S. military prevent the Taliban from marching on major cities or even Kabul? Will the civilian or the special immigrant visas for the contractors, the interpreters who worked with the Afghan military, get access to those visas? I had dinner tonight with one of those former interpreters who has been denied his application for the visa. He knows that Americans have been flying out today and that time is running out, and that him and many others feel completely left behind. And that lack of answers means a lack of answers for thousands of them across Afghanistan.
Our Jane Ferguson tonight in Kabul. Thank you very much.
As we reported earlier, health officials are sounding the alarm this holiday weekend that COVID-19's highly transmissible Delta variant is causing an increase in coronavirus cases in the U.S., and its greatest threat is to those who are unvaccinated. I spoke about this a short time ago with the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, thank you very much for joining us. We see the reporting that the Delta variant is now in all 50 states. How prevalent is it?
Well, Judy, it's quite prevalent. It's all over the country. It's doubling nearly every 2 weeks, and it will very quickly become the dominant variant in the United States. What's deeply concerning about it, Judy, is that it's highly transmissible, perhaps the most transmissible variant that we've seen to date. But the good news is that the vaccines that we have appear to be effective against the Delta variant. And if you are vaccinated, you are in good shape. You have a high degree of protection. My worry is for those who are not vaccinated, because this virus stands to spread even more quickly than other variants among the unvaccinated population. That's what we're seeing in Missouri and Nevada. And I worry that unless we quickly get more people vaccinated, we will see that in other states as well.
Well, that does suggest that the biggest worry is going to be in those places, whether it's rural areas or urban, those states where there is a lower vaccination rate. Are we looking at sort of two different pictures of the country here, where there's a high vaccination rate and a low vaccination rate?
Well, Judy, right now we are a divided country in terms of vaccination rates. We have some parts of our country that have 70%, 80% vaccination rates. We have others that are below 30% in parts of their region. So I'm worried about that, because that means that there are some parts of our country that are at significant risk, while others are relatively safe. And what we don't want to see is a scenario over the summer and in the fall where we have surges in those regions where we have low vaccination rates. But I fear that that is where we are headed unless we can quickly increase vaccination rates. That's one of the reasons, Judy, that the administration is also putting together a surge effort to help build teams that can go to areas that have been hard hit either by, you know, micro surges or that have low vaccination rates and can bring a series of resources to them, from assistance with expanding testing to vaccine administration to technical assistance to support their public health departments and also to get therapeutics to them, like monoclonal antibodies.
I hear you saying that, and we know the administration has been trying a number of different tactics to try to persuade people to be vaccinated, but we have a new poll we've been reporting on in the last couple of days, Dr. Murthy, showing that 28% of Americans are saying they do not plan to be vaccinated. How do you change the minds of people who are just dead set against it?
Well, Judy, one of the things I learned during my time practicing medicine and working with patients from a wide variety, you know, of backgrounds and points of view, is that you really have to understand where people are coming from, what their concerns are, and also who they trust. You know, we're a big country. People trust different institutions, different individuals. Not everyone's going to listen to officials from federal government or state government or local government. About 50% of people in polls say that they want to hear from a family member or friend as they make their decision about the vaccine. About 80% of people say they want to talk to their doctor or another medical professional about making a decision. That's why it's so important that we keep focus on this effort to mobilize trusted messengers to help people connect with informed individuals in their communities, whether those are doctors and nurses or faith leaders or family members. The problem we have, Judy, right now is that there is a lot of misinformation floating around. Two-thirds of people who are unvaccinated either believe common myths about COVID-19 vaccine or think those myths might be true. Myths like you can get COVID from the vaccine, which is absolutely not true. So we've got to dispel that misinformation, but the most important piece here are those trusted messengers. We're used to the notion that information is power, Judy, but what we've learned is that information alone isn't power. Information plus trust is what creates power. And in that sense, all of us have the ability to talk to our friends and family, help them get the information they need, help them go to vaccines.gov and find a place close by to get vaccinated. And that's how we can help protect the people we love.
And in the meantime, the advice is to people who are vaccinated, it's okay to go without a mask, but if you are unvaccinated, you should still be wearing a mask. Is that correct?
If you are unvaccinated, you are still at risk. And so you absolutely should still wear a mask, especially when you're in indoor settings with people from outside your household. You should keep distance from others, just like we've been advising people throughout the pandemic. If you are fully vaccinated, that means 2 weeks after your last dose of the vaccine, the science tells us that your chances of getting sick with COVID or transmitting the virus to others is low. And that's why the CDC gave people the flexibility to go without masks indoors or outdoors if they're fully vaccinated. With that said, Judy, there are some people who might still make the decision that they want to keep wearing masks. Maybe they're in a higher risk setting based on their own health. Maybe they live at home with people who are unvaccinated, or maybe in their community. There's a lot of spread of COVID-19 right now, and it's okay for people to make those decisions.
Is the Delta variant, Dr. Murthy, now the main reason for people to get vaccinated?
Well, I think it is certainly the most clear and pressing reason that we have right now for people to get vaccinated. Not only is it spreading fast, Judy, but what we've also learned in recent weeks and recent months is that it is not only hospitalizations and deaths that we worry about with COVID-19, but increasingly we are seeing people with what's called long-haul symptoms, with shortness of breath, chest pain, fatigue, brain fog that lasts for months beyond their infection. And we've seen this also with people who have had mild to moderate infections, and in some cases, even with asymptomatic infection. So if you're someone who's out there thinking, gosh, I'm not really at high risk. If I get sick, it might just be mild, but I won't get seriously ill. What we worry about is that even if you don't get hospitalized, that you may be at risk for long-haul symptoms. We've seen this in young people too. So these are all just more reasons for us to get vaccinated. But the Delta variant makes getting vaccinated even more urgent than it was before.
Dr. Vivek Murthy, the United States Surgeon General, we thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Judy. Take care, and happy 4th of July.
And you too. In the middle of an unprecedented heat wave and a worsening drought, western states in the U.S. are bracing for what could be an even harsher wildfire season than last year's, the worst on record. With many residents still picking up the pieces, they worry about what's on the horizon. Stephanie Tsai has this report from southern Oregon.
You can see where this area burned over here.
These are the charred remains of a section of the Bear Creek Greenway that burned early in the fire season. Too early. It's bone dry along the 20-mile trail that runs through Jackson County in southern Oregon. Just a spark in this tinderbox could become another disaster like it did last summer.
So there's vegetative fuels like this all along the Greenway, and the fire was just moving rapidly.
Bob Horton was the chief of Jackson County's Fire District 3 when the Almeda fire erupted last September, consuming the towns of Phoenix and Talent and leveling some 2,800 structures.
I remember vividly, like it was yesterday, coming across the radio saying, we have one chance to stop this fire.
Will Cleland, his battalion chief, says the first priority was saving lives.
The fire that day was forcing us to decide about neighborhoods. Not homes or streets, blocks of
like
streets.
Like which neighborhoods you would just have to let
burn. We were forced to decide which neighborhoods we would be passing by. And that's hard. These are real families.
I feel that was my last day.
Beatrice Gomez remembers the fire drawing closer, the ash, the smoke. She grabbed important papers and packed her kids into a van to flee, but soon found herself on a packed road surrounded on all sides by fires.
My brother called me. He said, where are you? I said, I'm stuck. And he told me.
You said I'm stuck?
I'm stuck in the fire. My 5 years old told everybody, close the eyes, because this is bad and everybody's scared.
They survived, but lost their house. She, her husband, and their four kids have been living in this cramped RV, which they were able to buy with their own money and a church donation. These RV parks are scattered throughout the area, filled with displaced fire survivors, many still traumatized by that day in September, which happened to also be Beatrice's birthday.
Are you still scared of wildfires?
Oh, yes, every day. Especially last week, we have a small fire close to here and see the smoke. And I look in every 5 or 10 minutes. When I start to feel the smell, I start to answer.
Get anxious.
I say, what did I do? So I put my paper again in the van. I have to run again. And my 5 years old daughter told me, hey, mom, the smoke maybe is for carne asada. You don't have to worry. After the fire, I put my kids for therapy with everybody. My old son screaming at night. My daughter too, and I hear he cry in the sleep.
The kids attend schools in the Phoenix Talent District, where Tiffany Lambert and Lucy Broussard work. The Almeda fire arrived on the first day of school last year.
I looked back and I saw the big plume of smoke, and that is when panic set in, and just hearing where the fire was and knowing that it was getting really close to some of our family's homes. And it was some of our most at-risk families, broke my heart.
The fire left one-third of students in Phoenix Talent School suddenly homeless.
I mean, our areas are just reaching the end of the cleanup phase.
So when you are looking at the school year starting in the fall, you're still going to have a big percentage of students that are displaced and not in permanent housing.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Officials estimate more than 400 families are still displaced. Among them, Alan Shepard's grandkids. With school out for the summer, they cooled off in a kiddie pool, hastily purchased on a day when temperatures broke all-time highs in southern Oregon. Like Beatrice Gomez, he says he had almost no warning to evacuate and could hardly save anything.
What was most valuable to you that you lost?
My whole home. And it hurts. What can you do? You know, stick your chin up and keep going on. Try to make it right for these guys.
He can't afford to rebuild or even rent.
I got four kids. You know, even to get into a three-bedroom, sure, I'm going to be up around $1,200, $1,300 a month. You know, and that, for me, that's not feasible.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying I might have to go off grid again, save enough money to buy a mobile home, you know, and then move it in on a park. That I can afford.
The hard-hit town of Talent still bears the scars of that September day.
Everything on one side of Talent Avenue completely annihilated.
Dominic Della Sala is a longtime Talent resident. He has spent years studying climate change and warning of its impact on wildfires. Della Sala had to evacuate along with all his neighbors. He feels lucky his home survived. But when he surveys the new construction in Talent, he sees how quickly it could all go up in flames again.
Part of me looks at this and says, we're not building better. I mean, this used to be a forest. And instead of being it out in the forest, it's in these buildings, and it's totally flammable. So if there's another fire in here, some point in the future, and we have seen these western towns burn not once, but twice, this is the worst possible way to build a house.
A new wildfire season is underway, which threatens to be worse than last year's.
All of the forecasts have been well above the level of danger or risk that we would have at this time of the year.
All right.
Fire Chief Bob Horton says they've learned from the Alameda fire and other explosive wildfires happening across the West.
We're getting greater fires of greater intensity and greater frequency of fire. We absolutely have to be more aggressive at managing the risk and just more effort and energy put into hardening homes in the wildland-urban interface, and it's the reducing the hazardous vegetation around people's properties.
Dominic Della Sala says the fires are part of runaway climate chaos, and without action to address that, future generations face more losses.
This community has struggled with a lot of grief. It's rebuilding itself, but in terms of the bigger picture, this is all connected. When we change our atmosphere, when we destroy our wild areas, we alter the climate so we're seeing fire misbehaving, causing catastrophic urban fire events.
If we try to attack this problem like we always have, assuming that it's the same problem, we will not find success. And if the environment we're operating in changes, and it obviously has, then we have to change too.
And change quickly, before the next fire becomes a catastrophe. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Southern Oregon.
Landmark decisions came down this week from the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. House Speaker Pelosi finally has a committee to look at the January 6th Capitol insurrection, and criminal charges came down on the former president's family business. Luckily, to help us better understand all of this, the analysis of Brooks and Capehart, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you. Very good to see you as we head into this July 4th weekend. A lot to talk about. Let's start with the Supreme Court decision on voting rights. David, it was a decision we've been waiting for, a very stark division between how the justices saw this in a lopsided 6-3 decision. How did you read what you saw from the justices?
Yeah, well, this is one of the few, surprisingly few 6-3 ideological decisions, but this was straight down party lines. I guess I have three reactions. The first is it's always worth reminding this is an answer to a problem that doesn't exist. There is no voting fraud or no major voting fraud. All these state rules, we don't need them. They're just in service to the Trump lie that the election was stolen. Second, the intent. I have every reason to believe the intent of the legislatures in all these places was to help their party, basically a white Republican party, and therefore they're trying to make it harder for people in the other party to vote. I imagine that's their intent. The impact is the crucial thing here. What is their disparate impact? And I only look at this from looking at the research. I don't look at it legally, but the research suggests the impact of all these kinds of voting changes is pretty minimal over the last 15 years, certainly not in the days of Jim Crow. It was not minimal back then. But in the last 15 years, when states have tried to make it easier to vote or make it a little less easy to vote, the impact on actual voting has not been that great. So it doesn't strike me as catastrophic. But the final thing to be said is, even though the impact is incremental, it's disparate. African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, they are more likely to be hurt. Even though the effects aren't big, they're not equally shared across all groups. So on the whole, I think the court made a mistake, but it's probably not a catastrophic one.
How do you see it, Jonathan?
Well, I don't know if I agree with David in terms of it not being catastrophic, simply because, to another point that David said, that this is a solution in search of a problem. As someone said to me once after I said that, pretty much the same thing on the show a few months ago, they said that's the wrong frame, because actually, from the Republican perspective, the problem is too many people are voting for Democrats. And in particular, too many people of color, i.e. black people, are voting. And that is the problem from the Republican perspective. And these laws are out there, and while it might not be catastrophic in terms of the way you view it right now, David, but it's really interesting that after African-American voters, people of color, the Democratic coalition came out en masse to vote for Joe Biden, to vote for Senators Warnock and Ossoff in Georgia, that all of a sudden there's a voter problem, a voting issue that needs to be solved. And that problem is that too many of those people are voting. And the idea that the Supreme Court would say, well, you know, it's not such a big deal, is really, it's just really a travesty and doesn't do anything for Chief Justice John Roberts' goal of trying to keep the Supreme Court looking like a neutral player. But when it comes to voting rights, Chief Justice Roberts isn't a neutral player in this.
Well, speaking of what happened in the Georgia vote, I happen to have a rare and very fortunately had an interview earlier this week with former President Jimmy Carter, was in Plains on the occasion of he and his wife Rosalynn about to celebrate their 75th wedding anniversary. And I just want to run a little excerpt of that interview, because I did ask him, David, about, we didn't know at that point what the court would do, but about what's happened in Georgia, these tightening laws. Here's part of what he said.
All over the world, we've always, ever since the Carter Center was founded, tried to promote maximum involvement in among the people in the election itself, and make sure that votes were counted accurately. And all of the things have gone by the board because of a Republican state legislature who take the position that Trump has espoused.
And he's saying, in other words, the changes, his own Carter Center, which has monitored elections around the world, was called on to monitor elections in Georgia. So you now have a situation where what the United States used to worry about and the rest of the world is happening here, David.
Yeah, you know, earlier this year, I read Ron Chernow's magnificent biography of Ulysses S. Grant, and as part of that biography, he covers the story of Reconstruction. He covers the story of when former slaves were given the vote and taken away. And so it's hard not to read that history, and hear some echoes today. So morally, I completely agree. If given the history of America, and if you're a legislator of any party, you do not want to be on the side of disparate outcomes along racial grounds. I mean, it's just abhorrent. I guess I would disagree with President Carter in that I do think the 2022 election is going to be a fair election. I don't think it's totally, we've totally trashed our system. And that's why I make the emphasis just that when you try to discriminate against people, one of the things that's happened, and this is not making it right, they come back at you harder. And so you get turnout increases when people perceive the legislatures are trying to turn us away. Whether that will still be the system long term is an open question. But I think overall, you know, we have mail-in ballots. We have longer voting periods than we did 20, 30 years ago. I still think, as much as one can be outraged by what's happening, our election system will be fair in 2022, I imagine.
And Jonathan, I was struck that in the poll that we did that came out this week with NPR and Marist, 79% of the respondents said they think it's good to require people to show a government ID before they can vote.
Sure. And, you know, Stacey Abrams, when the Joe Manchin compromise on the For the People Act came out, one of the things in there was voter ID. Stacey Abrams came out and said that she was fine with it. But that was just a one-sentence answer. The fine print of her answer is everyone's fine with voter ID. The problem comes in when some states demand only photo ID and not other forms of identification. And then when they demand photo ID, they then put restrictions on the kinds of photo IDs that can be presented. And so you have some, you have in some states where a student can't show their student photo ID, but someone can just show up and show their gun permit and be able to vote. And that is the issue. That is the problem. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask people to prove who they are. The problem comes in when you start picking and choosing which pieces of identification allow you to exercise your right to vote.
So much to ask the two of you about this week. David, I do want to raise the indictment that New York prosecutors handed down against a Trump business and his chief financial officer. My question to both of you is, how does this affect former President Trump's political fortunes?
Yeah, I guess for me, it would be, it remains to be seen still. I confess, if you had asked me how much corruption there was in the Trump organization, I would have expected way worse than some undisclosed fringe benefits. And so if that's all it is, then I would be underwhelmed. But that's probably not all it is. As every legal expert seems to be saying these days, they seem to have gone after this guy, Alan Weisselberg, as an attempt to turn him. He's been involved in Trump organization numbers for decades. And if they can hit him really hard, which they really hit him hard on these untaxed benefits, then, and if he's facing jail time, he would be certainly the person who would know all the secrets going all the way up to the top of the Trump organization. So if this is the beginning of a turning of a set of witnesses, then it really is very perilous for Trump. If this is all there is, I would be surprised, and Trump would be relatively safe from this kind of indictment.
Jonathan, how perilous for former President Trump?
In terms of his political standing, I don't think perilous at all. Probably the one of the truer statements ever to come out of Donald Trump's mouth came during the 2016 campaign when he said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any support. He has shown time and time and time again that that is true. For his diehard supporters, this is just one more piece of the quote-unquote and not true witch hunt against him. So I don't see this hurting him in any way with his true believers.
And the last thing I want to ask two of you about is something the president, former president, has denounced, David, and that is House Speaker Pelosi naming a select committee to investigate what happened, the insurrection at the Capitol on January the 6th. As you know, she tried very hard, Democrats tried very hard to get a commission created. Republicans blocked that in the Congress, in the Senate. But now there is a select committee. She's named several members, including Republican Liz Cheney, who's been critical of the former president. How much can we expect to learn from an organization, I mean, from an entity like this?
Well, we're not going to get the dispassionate, impartial viewpoint that I think a lot of us hoped for, but we're going to get a political process, and we'll probably get a majority Democratic report and a minority Republican report. I think a couple things are interesting to me. One is Liz Cheney is a really tough person. To go against her own leader and to accept this appointment from Nancy Pelosi, that shows she's just very tough. And she has decided that it's her oath to defend the Constitution to look into what happened on January 6th, and more power to her. As to what the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, does, I'm intrigued. Does he go, I assume he'll staff his side of the committee, because otherwise the Republicans will be silenced. Does he go and get super hard-charging, fire-breathing right-wingers who will make Fox happy and sort of disrupt the whole works, what Elise Stefanik has become? Or does he go with people who actually voted to certify the Biden election? I imagine he'll go with the hard chargers and we'll get something of a political theater. But I do think, even despite the theatrical elements that seem to be destined to, I do think we'll learn stuff just from witnesses, just from the back and forth of politics.
What are your expectations, Jonathan, from this? Do you think we will learn very much? How do you see it playing out?
Well, I do think we will learn a lot. But the key thing that everyone should keep in mind is that for Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is a deeply faithful person, devout Catholic, her love of the Constitution ranks up there as number two in terms of her, what she strongly believes in. And for her, as a member of Congress representing a district in California, as a constitutional officer, as Speaker of the House, for her, her allegiance and oath to the Constitution is inviolable. And the fact that people stormed the Capitol, on a really sacred day and sacred process for American democracy, certifying the election. It was an affront to her as an American and an affront to her as the Speaker of the House. She wants this committee because she wants to know what happened, why it happened, so that we can all learn how to prevent it from happening again. And so anyone who thinks that this is only a partisan exercise doesn't really understand who she is and why she is doing it, and more importantly, why she turned to Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney to be on that committee, because also someone from the opposite ideological spectrum from the speaker, but who also has made it clear from since January 6th that her oath is not to a person, but to the Constitution.
And one way or another, we're going to continue to hear about January the 6th. Even as we approach this national holiday, July 4th, we thank you both. We hope you have a good and safe holiday. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
Same to you, Judy.
The closing day of the Supreme Court term highlighted the power of the new six-justice conservative majority, as we've just been discussing. But the ideological divide can also reveal the power of a blistering dissent. Yesterday, that dissent came from Justice Elena Kagan, who said the majority undermined the Voting Rights Act by upholding two restrictive laws in Arizona. She wrote, and I quote, "What is tragic here is that the court has yet again rewritten in order to weaken a statute that stands as a monument to America's greatness and protects against its basest impulses." John Yang takes a look at another justice who delivered historic dissents while on the court during the Jim Crow era.
Judy, the name of Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan may not be widely known these days beyond law students and constitutional scholars. During his tenure from 1877 to 1911, the High Court enshrined racial segregation in American life. In the biggest of those cases, Harlan's vote was the lone dissent. He alone staked out positions that decades later would become the law of the land. Those visionary opinions led him to be known as the Great Dissenter, which is also the title of a new biography of Harlan by Peter Kanellis, the managing editor of Politico. Peter, thanks for being with us. What drew you to write about John Harlan?
Well, it started back when I was in law school 30 years ago. And as you know, it's often a dry affair reading legal books, but Harlan's opinions immediately sort of leapt off the page. You know, here was somebody who was bringing sort of a higher pitch of justice to his consideration of the law. It also was striking not only in the race cases, but also in some of these economic cases during the Gilded Age, that his opinion is the law of the land now and not that of the court majority of his era. I wanted to know why somebody would be so different from their colleagues at that time and yet be proven right in history.
He started out as a slave owner. He was born in a slave state, Kentucky. He disagreed with President Lincoln on emancipation and actually opposed his reelection. So how does he go from that to becoming champion of equal rights for freed slaves?
In the context of Kentucky politics, those stances were less resistant and conservative than you would think. There were essentially no Republicans in Kentucky. He was striving to keep the state neutral. And so, yes, he cut deals and, rallied very hard to get his fellow Kentuckians to stay in the Union. And part of that promise was they would be able to make their own decision on slavery. But that's why he was opposing some of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. Nonetheless, after the war, he came to believe that slavery was, in his own words, the greatest despotism of all time. Also, his personal association with African Americans, especially the one who was long rumored and believed to be his half-brother, Robert Harlan, who became a very prominent civil rights figure in Ohio, just across the river from Kentucky, and with whom he had a long-term and very respectful friendship and collaboration.
You're right about Robert. You say if there is a mystery to Harlan's story, the solution lies in the person of Robert Harlan.
Robert Harlan's an amazing man. he was a person of mixed race. He was believed to be the son of Harlan's father and an enslaved woman. Some DNA tests later on suggested that may not be the case, but nonetheless, he was believed to be a member of the Harlan family and had a special relationship with John's father. He was in a position to help John Marshall Harlan when Harlan wanted to get on the Supreme Court. Northern liberals were very skeptical of this Kentuckian who came from a slave-owning family. So behind the scenes, Robert Harlan was able to reassure people of John Harlan's good intentions regarding African-Americans at a time when most people doubted him. And then he went on to become the greatest defender of African-American rights of his time and perhaps of American history.
You talk about the sort of the Gilded Age and a lot of these. There's not just the race cases that but economic cases that where the Supreme Court sided with the moneyed interest over workers on things like work hours and that sort of thing. As you looked at those cases, did you feel any parallels or were there echoes of the court's direction today?
One of recent vintage that sort of has a little of that air to it is the Citizens United case. I think the basic situation during the Gilded Age was you had a Supreme Court that was much more conservative than the rest of the country and very much out of touch with what average people were experiencing. That was the result of having a long, unbroken string of essentially pro-business presidents. Harlan was much more in touch with the country coming from Kentucky. He was not rich. He understood what was going on, and he was every bit as aggressive a dissenter in those cases as he was in the race cases. What's amazing to me is today, in all of those cases, the race cases, the away civil rights, voting rights, education, and the endorsed the Separate But Equal Act, and then in these economic cases, Harlan's views prevailed. At his time, he was just one person standing against the crowd.
His dissent in the in Plessy versus Ferguson, which established the doctrine of separate but equal, was sort of the roadmap for Thurgood Marshall in Brown versus Board of Education. And today, Harlan is a hero to both sides, to conservative legal scholars and justices on the Supreme Court, and also liberal scholars. Talk a little bit about that.
Conservatives see Harlan as a positive figure, as a person who believed in the original intent and plain meaning of the Constitution. When he stood up for equality in Plessy v. Ferguson, he was, you know, saying equal protection means equal protection. He was also saying the people who passed that amendment intended to create a state of equality for African Americans. Liberals, on the other hand, will look at him and say, here's a man who had a real sense of how the Supreme Court's decisions can affect people on the ground.
You also say that Harlan was unique in that his dissents eventually became the law of the land, that there was no, there hasn't been as forceful a dissenter. But do you see any parallel or any analog on the court today?
Well, certainly the court liberals and a lot of people associated this with the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, shifted to a position of dissent in the last 4 or 5 years. I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her later years really looked to Harlan as an example of what she wanted her own legacy to be.
The book is The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero, the author Peter Kanellis. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a quick announcement before we say goodnight. The NewsHour's launched a new digital series called Five Stories. In each episode, host Dima Zain will recap five captivating stories you may have missed, all in about 3 minutes. You can find the latest episode every Friday on our YouTube channel or on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour. Stay with PBS. You don't want to miss Yamiche Alcindor and her panel unpack the criminal charges against the Trump Organization and a top executive. That's tonight on Washington Week. And be sure to join us here Monday for my rare, wide-ranging interview with former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, as they prepare to celebrate their 75th wedding anniversary, the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and enjoy celebrating this 4th of July weekend.